And one of the questions I find myself asking when I hear a lot of, you know, whether it be the right or the left, the woke or the red pill, however you want to taxonomize all that, when I hear them, one of the things I find myself asking is, is anybody even interested any longer in the project of persuasion?
Welcome to What in God's Name and our kickoff of our 2023-2024 program season. I'm Chris Owen. My colleagues Shana and Brandon will be joining me in upcoming shows. As you will be hearing, the essential question that we're asking this season, what are the moral foundations of democracy? Today's conversation with Joseph Minnick, like all of our conversations here on What in God's Name, is rich and full. Come to the table with us. We're asking important questions and thinking about things differently than what you usually get. Welcome to What in God's Name. We're talking today with Dr. Joseph Minnick. But before I introduce Joseph, I want to mention that joining us on today's call is one of our Patreon supporters, Rob Wills. And Rob will have an opportunity to engage in conversation a little bit later. And if you, dear listeners, would like the kind of access to our guests that Rob is having today, become part of the community supporting our work on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com and then in the search bar, look for whatingods.com. As I say, we're talking today with Dr. Joseph Minnick. He's currently the residential teaching fellow at the Davenant Institute in Landrum, South Carolina. His most recent book is Bulwarks of Unbelief, with the subtitle of Atheism and Divine Absence in a Secular Age, which you can find on Amazon and I'm sure other places as well. And we'll put a link, Joseph, to your book in our show notes. Joseph is here to help us think about democracy, which is the theme for What in God's Name this fall. But, before we get to that, we'd like to ground our listening community in our guests' stories. So, Joseph, help us to get to know you a little bit. Where did you come from, and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I suppose that's a narrative. I believe in the taxonomy of one relatively prominent stand-up comedian these days. I would be considered a senior millennial. So I was born in 82. I just make the cutoff, turned 18 in the year 2000. Born in the LA area, not a shadier part of the LA area, I suppose. My parents split when I was very young, and so my mom remarried a good blue-collar gentleman in the Dallas area where I was raised. We wound up moving to Dallas. Was raised in the Dallas area. That's where my that's where most of my life was until I married my wife. And mostly a kind of, I suppose, in kind of American taxonomy, people would think of it as kind of your kind of homeschooling evangelical home in the 90s. That's basically my background. My parents, probably everybody who's a bit older, you know, 20, 30 years older than me, remembers the kind of charismatic renewal Jesus movement in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s. My parents kind of come out of that spiritually. And so my earliest kind of intellectual and spiritual pedigree was kind of in that sort of Jesus movement kind of thing. You know, I think Calvary Chapel or something like that. Progressively, again, evangelical home, entered the Presbyterian world, I'd say, in my early 20s, and the academic world at that time as well, mostly working on questions, I suppose the same headspace you see occupying what a lot of people call the ex-evangelical movement these days, right? People kind of deconstructing the faith of their youth, that sort of thing. I suppose the headspace I've often trafficked in could be described as similar. though not with the degree of deconstruction. And so, you know, I'd still consider myself an evangelical, attempt to be a thoughtful one, attempt to be one that can engage others and whatever. And I don't totally dismiss my parents, but, you know, I also have thoughts about other things and that sort of thing. So I guess I'm, you know, just on a pilgrimage, and I consider myself, you know, an evangelical of this generation, something like that.
Yeah, thanks for that. And I mean, from what I know of your, from conversations that we've had, Joseph, I mean, your mind definitely has a philosophical cast to it. You seem to enjoy thinking philosophically about things. So not just theologically, but philosophically. And you love ideas. And I'm curious, you know, in your story, can you identify, like, I don't know, there, it's probably too grand to think that there might be a moment, but how did you get in touch with that gift that you have of thinking philosophically about things?
Yeah, I think some of that was, this is a very weird answer to that. I think some of that was actually, some of it's a natural inclination. I've always kind of been curious, and there's questions about things. You hear, you know, Sunday school lessons and that sort of thing. And you know, you have your questions, you don't feel like, well, you know, the third grade Sunday school answer wasn't good enough, you know, that sort of thing. And that builds up over time. And as you develop into an intellectual in your teens or early 20s or something like that, you just kind of keep exercising those muscles. And then the community identifies sort of like, oh, it looks like that's your thing, right? And so some of it was deeply internal movement, a lot of community affirmation in that direction. I think some of the more extreme elements of that orientation probably, this is a weird answer, but come from maybe some early childhood trauma, actually, where you, and I don't mean in any super unique way, lots of people have that, right? But you can, some types of trauma can kind of get you to unattach a bit from the world in such a way that you just live in your head. And so I think a lot of the, oddly, and God has redeemed that, I think, and there's good things that have come out of that. But I think I've always been kind of extremely living in my head, and it's been a process of maturation, I suppose, to come outside of it. Nevertheless, that's a journey, and starting, being in your head as a starting place when you're an early child, I suppose, tends to make it possible that you'll become one of those weird people who actually goes and does philosophy eventually. So I guess I was destined, yeah, or something like that. There you go.
That's a beautiful and fascinating answer. And you actually shared my follow-up question was going to be, are you an only child? I mean, you're describing this living in your mind and in your head. Resonates deeply with me, and so I appreciate your
yeah,
sharing.
Yeah, and
I'm not.
I'm one of four, actually. Yeah.
Oh, you're not an only. I thought you said you were an only child. No.
Oh no. I'm one of four. Yeah. Well, I don't know what word I used, but probably there's a word that sounded like only in there somewhere.
I think I wanted you to say that, so
oh,
I heard
okay.
it.
Oh, okay. You apparated it out of thin air. That's how it works, brother. Yes, one of four. I'm three of four. I'm number three of four boys. Mom had four kids, four boys by the age of 24. So we were quite the crew. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a story there too.
Yeah. But, there's a lot of stories
sure.
up in here, brother.
That's intense. Like for your mom. Wow. So yeah, thanks for sharing that piece of your story. And I would just say, I want to say this to our listening community, which is, you know, for our audience, it can be a little bit confusing. I think it was a little bit confusing for me for a while too, because I wasn't in contact with self-described evangelicals. Mm. And so there definitely is this stereotype that if you're an evangelical, you're not a thoughtful person, you're not a thinker, and you are. And so I want to say that, you know, just to our listening community, I would just say this one other thing is that for some reason I tend to gravitate to really thoughtful evangelicals. It's just like something that happens in my life story. I think
we're like little sirens for you.
It's a little bit like, I'll just share a little bit of my biography, which is I went to college and found something I didn't think existed, which was a really smart, intelligent, faithful people. And that changed my world, because I didn't think such a thing existed. And so then it became a possibility for me, not that it happened right away. So all of which is to say that my gravitation towards smart evangelicals is the similar kind of thing, which is here is people of faith who can think. So, and that, I think, for much of our listening community is... It scrambles the signals, because the stereotype is that if you're a faithful person, you've checked your intellect at the door.
Right. Yeah. That's a very common perception. And yeah, I use the term in a sense. I suppose I do this with a lot of words, in that I don't want certain terms to be reduced to their kind of journalistic stereotypes, more or less. Evangelical had a certain meaning up until the 70s, and really it's around the 80s and 90s that it begins to take on this kind of contemporary journalistic definition, and then there's a lot of things associated with it, which of course I'm not endorsing at all. But I think it's useful as a way of capturing certain very, very basic commitments. But you are correct; it can be there are streams of it, and sometimes the stereotype is correct. There can be a definite anti-intellectualism in it, and that sort of thing. And yet it's really just about finding the exceptions, and finding the exceptions in a way that is even rooted in the principles, which is to say, does this movement, which sometimes produces people that just are suspicious of philosophy, actually wind up having something to even offer philosophy? And I think that's the kind of tension that I suppose I find myself living in and trying to live out of.
Thank you for that. Let's pivot to our topic for today. The What in God's Name essential question for this fall is, what are the moral foundations of our American democracy? That's an intentionally broad question that can be taken in different directions. One direction that I thought of as I was preparing to have this conversation with you, Joseph, is... why is democracy a good thing? I mean, that's one way to slice the bigger question of the moral foundations of democracy. Why is democracy a good thing? Why is democracy better than, say, autocracy? And I'm not laying out that question as that's what we're going to talk about. I'm just kind of trying to set the context here a little bit of our big question. So that's one way to understand our essential question. Another one is, what virtues do people in a democracy need to have in order for democracy to work? What virtue, an old-fashioned word, virtue, what virtues do people in a democracy need to cultivate for the democracy to thrive? So an observation, again, I'm just setting some context for us. An observation is that lots of people are wondering about the health of American democracy. So if you Google the phrase democracy in trouble, as I did in preparation for this conversation, you will get a treasure trove of articles with titles like Democracy in Crisis or Is Our Democracy Under Threat? You will get a litany of words like trouble, risk, danger, broken, problem, crisis. All of these words connected with democracy. Is our democracy under threat? And the other thing about this, another observation I want to make, Joseph, is this is not new. There's a wonderful article by Jean Bethke Elstein, who was a wonderful thinker at the University of Chicago. She died in 2013. But an article in the spring of 2000, so before 9/11, 23 years ago, the first sentence of her piece is, there is widespread agreement that American democracy is in trouble. 23 years ago. And probably, you know, and you could probably fairly easily find, find, let me finish that thought before I begin the next one. All right. You could probably find a lot more examples of that before 2000. And I would add, that might be a theme throughout American history. Like, you know, it's the perennial, there could be a perennial, could be a perennial question. All right. So, pivoting towards a question and giving you a chance, Joseph. The Liberal Democratic Project, and liberal now understood as a political philosophy, not a political party. That's important because people hear the word liberal and it immediately flashes with a donkey in the color blue. but liberal as a political philosophy begins with emphasizing individuals and their freedom and their rights. So we get the story, you know, you pursue your happiness, I'll pursue my happiness. And as long as your pursuit doesn't interfere with my pursuit, we're good to go. And so a critique, and I want to start with the critique of that kind of perspective, because I don't want our conversation to be, I think it's just too easy to say, yeah, rah, rah, we need rah, rah, rah for democracy. We just need it. It's wonderful. It's good. I think a richer conversation is to really take seriously the critiques and the criticisms. So a critique of you pursue your happiness, I'll pursue mine. A critique of that is without some shared vision of the good, your society or your polity or both is in danger of fragmenting, of atomizing into something like, oh, I don't know, 2023 United States of America. So is that, my question for you is that an inherent weakness of a liberal democracy? And before I stop talking, I would say, if you want to parse that question or change that question a little bit or just nuance it in whatever way is helpful for you, Joseph, go ahead. That's the critique of democracy of liberal democracy I want to start with.
I think these are perennial questions, and that's such it's such a fascinating inquiry, and there's a lot of ways to parse it out. And I should admit here that in one sense we're talking about an item of significant public concern, but I also want to signal that I'm probably not the smartest person in the world about the critiques of the liberal order and defending democracy. Brad Littlejohn has a forthcoming book that I think will be very, very helpful on this question, just to throw that out to listeners. But just to pull that apart in a few ways, part of what I think we'd have to be honest about if we're looking at our democracy or our democratic republic, however you want to say that, is implied in what I just said, which is a lot of the founding fathers were critical of the term democracy. And there's been a rhetorical shift in the history of the country such that democracy is almost intrinsically a good word now, and it wasn't always so. And sometimes the debate, I think, especially in culture war context, sometimes the debate between those two views can be overly semantic. So it's like democracy versus not democracy. And maybe more nuanced positions are able to say democratic republic. So we're not strictly speaking majority rule if 51% of people think something, that's the law. But we are thinking that, you know, republic meaning government by law, democracy meaning laws and representatives of those laws and enforcements of those laws are largely shaped by the people. They're voting, the people they get in to interpret laws and that sort of thing. And so part of what I'd want to say is start there, like what exactly are we defending? Nevertheless, baked into the American order, into American society, even if we do call it a democratic republic, if we want to qualify that, is a strong sense of the individual, of individual rights and that sort of thing. And there is a question of the balance between that emphasis upon individual freedom, individual capacity to sort of make their way in the world and that sort of thing, and the common good, because can't individuals kind of running around by themselves kind of create a situation where they undo the common good for a bunch of others, and then you just have kind of Machiavellian tribes of individuals at this point? And think the modern business world and that cutthroat kind of mentality, that's very, very often what can happen. I think it's important to note on that score then that it's always been recognized that the kind of country America was set up to be, as imperfect as it was originally, as imperfect as it's always been and is now, it was always understood that if that's going to work, that will be its tendency apart from some countervailing virtues. So what you said is just right. That old word virtue, which just really connotes like a fixed habit in ourselves. And what I think you see in for all the ways people criticize the Founding Fathers or criticize some of the early political philosophy or think it needs to change in some way, maybe there's some truth to that. But one thing that seems clear seems baked into the DNA of the country and it seems baked into the rhetoric of the fathers as well, is that America has always been a society of adult mutuality. So there's a very interesting book by a guy named Robert Pogue Harrison, who actually is at University of Chicago as well. And he wrote a book called Juvenescence, A Cultural History of Our Age. And he makes this fascinating claim in the book that America is both the youngest country in the world, but also the oldest country in the world. Because it inherits a tradition. It inherits the human tradition and a whole tradition of political philosophical reflection and knows that it is building something on top of that is new. And that is not to start over. That is actually to enter a stage, you might think of, a kind of adult mutuality with what that necessitates. And so you find them very consciously reflecting early on, if this nation loses some degree of people having a sense that they need to self-possess, if kind of self-possession doesn't become kind of pressured in the hive mind, we're likely going to pull apart. And the foreign exemplar of this who really comments on America insightfully is de Tocqueville, right? Both Joshua Mitchell and Anthony Cronman have both written recently on de Tocqueville. And de Tocqueville really seems to be the guy that comes along in America and says, this is a fascinating country. It works really well in a certain way, but it only works if people do this. And if they don't, it doesn't work. And now he's writing in the middle of the 19th century, and maybe there's things that have changed since then. But I think these are the kinds of things that kind of come to mind when I think about the moral foundations of democracy, is that we were handed, in a sense, an apparatus where a certain degree of virtue was expected. Has the apparatus adjusted for what's really there? Did we ever have that virtue? That's a different question. But I think what Cronman's book does, the last thing I'll say and just pass it back to you, what Cronman's book does, I'm trying to think of the title, Anthony Cronman, former dean of Yale Law, he writes a book called it's The Pursuit of American Excellence or something like that. I can't remember quite the title, but he's trying in the book to really recognize a distinction in between democratic values and values for excellence. In other words, the best statue, you know, the best art, the best book, the best literature, the best poem, that's not a democratically decided thing. Better is better. However, there's something incredibly important about democratic values and democratic institutions around those values. And what he sees is, he kind of reads John Adams and de Tocqueville, and what Mitchell argues is America has to have institutions that protect a hierarchy of excellence and protect democratic values and then mediate between them for America functionally to work. And he sees the university. The university used to be the institution that kind of protected excellence. And now when the values of democracy take over education, which has a kind of hierarchical excellence quality as well, then you perhaps lose that mediation between the two spheres, something like that.
That's fascinating and so juicy, and I want to get into that. And what I mean by that is this tension between democratic values and excellence. And I want to bracket that and set it aside for a second, because there was one other thing I wanted to pursue before that. I love this phrase, adult mutuality, which I'm taking to mean to be a description of how basically citizens ought to act. I mean, is that a fair?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. I think the idea there is, yeah, that's right.
So let's name some of the ways that we can be adults in the public square, and because I think it's worth doing, and not that we'll come up with an exhaustive list, and not to say that these things are the panacea for what ails us, but it does seem important to be able to. I mean, this gets at the question of the moral foundations within individuals that mm-hmm. allow us to be self-governing. And it's really, I think part of what I'm attracted to in this, Joseph, is the metaphor, but it's not a metaphor of adult. I mean, if you extend it as a metaphor, then the opposite of being a citizen is being a bratty child or an undisciplined teen who can't think beyond 24 hours ahead or something like that. So I think it's a rich way to frame it. So one thing I think about being an adult is you don't always get your way, and that doesn't mean that you take your ball and go home. So let me start there. Just toss that out. I mean, any response to that? Or
I think actually that's the in one sense that is the maybe the most important part of what we have to say about America, is that part of the original formula, and some of this is the historical accident of having the frontier. And the story of America is irreducibly such a story of so many different people with different programs that in Europe would otherwise have been killing each other. But in America, they can keep running away from each other for 150 years. And so there's nobody that can do anything about that. And so you have, in a way, to have a united country, you just have to recognize that what was on the ground, phenomenologically, whether I like it or not, what just simply exists on the ground is already a highly, highly, highly diversified family, if you're going to make it a formal political family. And at that point, yeah, it's kind of like family rules. If you're in a tribe and we can really just talk about our own family, you know, maybe you have a parent with a couple of kids and there's tension in the family that's existed for 30 years and somebody decides I'm going to do something about that. Well, you can just go in a room and insist on your own way. That's probably not going to go very well. Or you can go through the complex negotiation, understanding, but also standing up for yourself process. That's actually the only real tested pathway to create a healthy family dynamic. And so, some of the criteria I think about along these lines, and some of it's for me, Chris, what this winds up doing is kind of generating kind of questions in my head. How do you test for a virtue like that? And one of them is, do we just recognize, because this is baked into the formula, but have we slowly lost the recognition that that individual over there, if they're a citizen, actually just does have some birthright to say what they want about the common good and have a birthright to access to that common good? In other words, even if what I think they're doing is sinister and they think what I'm doing is sinister, in as much as we are part of the same family of a sort, they do have the right, just as I do, a birthright. It's not a right I give to them or withhold from them. It's something I simply recognize. There's a regal sense that you have to have about fellow citizens such that I don't actually get to say, I get to say, like, you know, the state should stop people causing violence and whatever, but I don't actually get to say, given our system, given the family rules, if you will, that you can't speak into the common good any more than I can't speak into the common good, or that you can say I can't speak into the common good. And what I would add to that is, what you can't lose, well, you can lose it, but what's going to hurt is if you lose the virtue associated with all of that, of even being interested in the task of persuasion. So again, go back to the broken family narrative. One way that broken families, usually, this is the normal human thing to do, right? Is just everybody go to their spot and be quiet and don't talk to each other, right? But eventually that's not good. Eventually that's going to create problems that fester. And one of the questions I find myself asking when I hear a lot of, you know, whether it be the right or the left, the woke or the red pill, however you want to taxonomize all that, when I hear them, one of the things I find myself asking is, is anybody even interested any longer in the project of persuasion? Have we rhetorically postured ourselves when we talk out loud as though time for persuasion is over, we are at rhetorical war, and there are simply winners and losers now? There is the winning side and the losing side, and there's part of me that just says that that cannot be. There's no way that's a sustainable attitude within a democracy. I think that it's, no, I say within a democracy, just within in any modern civilization. And I think it's, I suppose part of this comes from, you know, in the 90s when I was, you know, again, kind of conservative evangelical homeschooler in the 90s, I remember kind of the evangelical radio talk about Bill Clinton back in the day. And it's real funny, right? If you talk to evangelicals now, Bill Clinton is like, you know, wow, he was kind of a conservative president compared to the last, you know, however many years. But back in the day, you know, if you were listening to evangelical talk radio, he was the Antichrist. And of course, if you listen to kind of, at the time, woke wasn't a word back then, but let's just say kind of progressive talk radio, you could also get like, oh, all these, you know, evangelical fascists and that sort of thing. And what's been odd to me over my lifetime is then it was very clear to me, these people are projecting. Most of these comments about the evangelicals I know don't describe most evangelicals I know. But most of the things the evangelicals I know are saying don't really describe the people that I see over there who are. However, over 30 years, it's as though we're progressively growing into the way we've labeled each other. And instead of naming and summoning and then maximizing the good of our neighbors, we've seen, summoned, named, and maximized in some ways the very pathologies that we've projected and kind of made large. And it's as though we've summoned the worst out of each other in something like that in the last 30 years. And that strikes me as, and again, that attitude of, was persuasion already over? Did we start even back then just deciding, no, that's not a game we can play? And it's here that I go back to, I'll stop after this, but I always mention when I talk about things like this, Daryl Davis, this African-American jazz musician in the D.C. area. He was a boogie-woogie pianist, I think born in the late 50s. But he had this random life where he's persuaded 200 members of the KKK to leave the KKK. And he's done this largely through 20 years of getting breakfast and becoming friends with them. And all I can say is when I look at that, it's like, that's possible. And yet if in the late 70s, somebody sat down and said, hey, I'm going to go get breakfast. If an African-American said, hey, I'm going to go get breakfast with some KKK guys, you know, folks, wish me luck. You wonder how many people would just think, well, that's the stupidest waste of time imaginable. But you have to decide that actually persuasion is possible, or you won't go do it. And I think that to me is a very core crisis for us, is that we've lost the role of the public sphere. And I think there's a lot of reasons for this, technology and blah, blah, blah. We'll get into that. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, yeah. There are a lot of reasons for that. There are a lot of reasons for that. Let me just say it for the third time. A piece of what I gravitate towards as I was listening to you is, it's really, how do we form people to, and I mean, when I say form, I'm thinking of the word form in its deepest theological resonance, which is, what is formation? Like, the inculcation, the developing habits in certain ways, developing habits, developing virtue, developing the moral vision, developing the cast of mind that buys into the project of persuasion. I thought you said that very well, because that captures, I mean, it's, if you are on board with the project of persuasion in the public square, then part of what becomes a value, part of what becomes a good, is the conversation itself. you don't come in and say, my job is to end the conversation forever because I have the right answer. My group has the right answer. Now, this gets really tricky, though, because because people also need to come to the public square with conviction as to their vision of what counts as human flourishing, what counts as the good, what counts as true and beautiful as well as good. So what happens when, I think about this a lot, Joseph, and I'd love to hear you respond, but what happens when we get a fair amount of people who are so convinced that our society is going to hell that they don't have any patience for democratic niceties? What I will say, democratic niceties. They've given up on the project of persuasion because things are so bad. There needs to be radical seizing of power, coercion. Like, we get into that kind of mindset. To me, that is worrying. Not that it exists, because it's always going to exist. But if that gets traction, then you are in dangerous territory. And I don't want to say, I would love to actually explore what that dangerous territory is, because I think there's some moral and theological reflection there on what the danger is. But before I get there, your response to what I just said.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that in many ways there is this perception that things are so bad right now that the task of persuasion, we don't really have time for the task of persuasion, right? So it's like, well, Hitler is invading Poland right now and we don't have time to stop the soldiers and invite them to breakfast. Oh, and there are aspects. And part of this is that we frame fights in one way, and there's a lot of fights. There are, in any given, I mean, America's complicated, states are complicated. There are legal initiatives, there are positive movements in America that, depending on your view of something, you do have to go into a political fight. So there is such a thing, fight. Friends can even fight, right? You can be personal friends and on a particular issue, political opponents, right? You know, that's in fact, that's just been, that literally is the DNA of America. It's whether or not that can be done sustainably. I think one of the things going on beyond just, we could talk about the whole history of the breakdown of local trust. We could talk about, and I think that's a huge part of the story, is how does trust get mediated in a heavily technologized and then a heavily interneted culture. The internet has, I think, done more to help the internet is not good at forming virtue, to put it in the way you just put it. It is perhaps formed, we're all sinners and probably more weak than we realize in lots of ways. And the internet is interacting or acting on our lizard rat brains in ways that are probably not helping us develop the kinds of virtues that create a sustainable political order, except for podcasts like this, of course. Here's where this is what saves civilization right here. It's all Chris's credit. I think it's important to remember when we think about what to do, part of what's going on, I think, is that the public sphere no longer feels like a site of persuasion. The public sphere feels like a site of Machiavellian propaganda fighting, where there's not really anybody doing persuading. There's several people shouting, and it's whoever shouts the loudest kind of that wins. And it's important to recognize that the public sphere is a historically peculiar institution. It wasn't always with us, as it turns out. And it really does grow out of the early modern period, it grows in the context of early modern religious wars. And the public sphere, in a lot of ways, functioned as that site where tense inter-civilizational and international debates could, and even local debates could be resolved. This is why you have, you know, the kind of your stereotypical go talk about this at a coffee shop. In the early modern period, when you see the development of what becomes named the public sphere, it's largely this absorber, it's not meant to be a space of propaganda, but actually a space where real conversation and persuasion happens. And as you see the advent of progress, you know, the printing press and more media and these sorts of things, it's always been the kind of space that can be colonized by kind of manipulative rhetoric and propaganda and that sort of thing, but it functions best when there's an eyeball on real conversations that result in real persuasion. And part of what I think is going on as well in the modern public sphere, and this is where I'm only half joking about podcasts, is that I actually think very few people have even seen persuasion. One of the reasons people don't believe it anymore is, when's the last time you saw two people talk about something difficult and hard and one person go, "Ah, maybe you're right about that"? It seems it's so like it's a, persuasion is almost theoretical. And the example I use with my students is maybe you saw this Mr. Rogers documentary about Mr. Rogers' life. But there's this famous moment when early on in Fred Rogers' career, when he's sitting in front of Congress, and there's I think it was during the end of the Vietnam War, and there's this senator from New York who has to decide whether to give $20 million to PBS to keep it running. And so there's this panel of guys, really, really grouchy New York senator, and all these PBS execs sit in front of this guy, and they just one by one, just like, "I can't believe that children's programming, I have to," and, you know, "next," you know, just crass-hearted senator. And then Mr. Rogers sits down, and in 5 minutes, for real, like you watch this at a congressional hearing, it's like he just talks to him like a human. He assumes that he has a common value that he can reach. He goes right into him, pulls it out, and in 5 minutes, the guy says, "Well, it looks like you got your $20 million. And he just gave it to him live. You know, I've never seen that. I've never seen somebody go from completely on one side to another side like that. But it can happen, and I think in one sense, it's hard to say how it happens, because we've so underdeveloped, I think, the virtues, both rhetorical, conversational, and intellectual, that really enable us to even imagine what it's like to communicate to, because we're such talking point people. When we talk to people, we go into a robot mode. We've memorized a couple of Ben Shapiro mic drops, or maybe it's Keith Olbermann mic drops, who cares? One or the other. And then we just regurgitate them like drones. And talking for real is more profound than that, and takes some humility and openness of soul. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Joseph, I love being in conversation with you. It feeds my soul. It feeds my soul. Rob, would you like to add to the conversation or ask Joseph a question?
My number one is, you're probably both familiar with Matthew 22. Love the Lord your God and your neighbor as yourself. And so I think my observation on American society, and perhaps the world, maybe less so in other places. I grew up in Australia, so I've seen a different society, and I have cousins in England, and I've lived there for a while. But I think love your neighbor as yourself has become conditional. There's a yes, but I'll love my neighbor as myself, but only if they hold my views, or they're in my socioeconomic strata, or they happen to live in this country and not the third world, or something like that. So that's an interesting observation. A little discussion on persuade versus propaganda. I really like that line of thinking, Joseph. And I think another way of going there is to say persuasion is a loaded word, because if I'm trying to persuade you on something, that means I've got to lean and I'm pushing my case. So maybe fair debate is another way of looking at how do we resolve things. And I have an example in my own life, and that is, I'm an engineer and I work with other engineers, and we work very closely. And quite often I'll say, "Well, let's do it this way." And then one of the other guys will say, "Ah, yes, but if we did it this way, it'd be better." And inherent in that process is listening and respect and good relationships. And there are processes that were mapped out. One of my mentors at Dartmouth College invented something called the science court, where you have two strong adversaries and you bring them together and you sit down, and on the chalkboard you put down your agreed propositions, and then you debate in a respectful way the disagreed propositions, as opposed to just throwing mud. And I've done that and used it. It was pretty amazing. And here's my question. What is the basis for this split in tribalism? Where does it come from? Is it fear? Is it superiority, like American exceptionalism, that would separate us from other countries? Where does the tribalism come from? There you go.
Thanks, Rob. Thank you so much. And Joseph, you wanna take a swipe at any or all of those?
Yeah, I can speak to a little bit. Those are good observations. Very briefly, yeah, I think that distinction between persuasion and propaganda is extremely important to explore, because one of the things, even when you study the rhetoric of something like a sermon, I like part of what I teach at Davenant Hall is really focused on rhetoric, and so I've been long interested in, like, on the one hand, the rhetoric of the sermon is irreducibly a kind of rhetoric of persuasion, but how do you distinguish kind of emotional manipulation from something that's really bringing along a free soul by their own agency? And so in one sense, you're actually moving the mind naturally in another, the soul naturally in another, as opposed to kind of vibing them into your position, which is what I think a lot of rhetoric can do through kind of direct appeal to other things. When it comes to tribalization more specifically, of course, that's a tribalization has all these aspects. So there's always been deep, you guys know this, there's always been very deep tensions in American society, not just North and South, but kind of your urban versus rural classes and that sort of thing. That's always been quite a tension in American society. But I think what you see progressively in the 20th century is the evaporation of ordinary places where people formerly experienced those kind of cathartic offsetting sites of mediation. So one way to put that is, if you live in a small town and you don't use the automobile that much, and there's 300 people and they all disagree about things, the points of contact in a small town of 300 to 500 or 1,000 or 5,000 people are so multifaceted. You go to church with them, you see them at the market, you get your haircut, and so you're bumping into them in a million ways. And I think what happens progressively with our technologies, with mobility and all these sorts of things, with our patterns of life, is that we are able to tailor our lives where we actually don't have to bump into each other in that way. But I think that does a couple of things. One is it progressively makes people abstract. So what is that person in the discussion group? They're a collection of ideas. And what is everybody else? They're also collections of ideas. But especially when you add, what I would say is, I don't think we can understand contemporary tribalization without the advent of the internet. It was already trending in a lot of these ways, I think, for the last several decades. But when you add the internet into it, the degree to which that does something to our social lizard brain, where everything is signals, and where people, it's very hard for us, and I'm a sinner too. I'm not talking about other people, I'm talking about me. It's very hard for us when it's like, let's say I didn't know Chris at all, and all I knew was his Twitter feed, and all his Twitter feed was one kind of thing. Well, then all Chris is to me is that guy. And that's just, it's very hard, I think, for us to, because we're made to pattern detect with people, but we were made to pattern detect with people in a kind of embodied ecosystem of contacts. And that system is kind of operating still socially when we go on Twitter, but that's not a whole human. And there's an incredible spiritual temptation, both whether you're on the right of the political spectrum, the left of the pedal, whether you're a Trumper, whether you are a total anti-Trumper, everyone, I think, has a tendency right now to really be tempted to reduce people to kind of an online projection. And that's very dangerous, but also it's very hard. It's very hard not to do that.
Do you think You can think of religion essentially as a continuum between rationality and perhaps otherworldly or magical thinking. I think there is a pretty strong amount of the magical thinking part and perhaps less rationality. But could you comment on that one?
I don't know that I'd personally frame it that way, but I think I understand what you're saying. When you say, is religion on a spectrum between rationality and magical thinking, are you thinking in terms of, help me understand the distinction you're making there.
I think it's hoping that God will intervene.
There's something, maybe there's a tension between the profound realism that religion has to sit in a world where we're not experiencing miracles all the time, and yet also be hopeful for what, for possibilities. Yes, I think I see where the question is coming from now. Hopeful for possibilities that don't seem likely, calculably likely. For those who, very briefly, Luigi Gisani's little book, The Religious Sense, just got retranslated. Luigi Gisani, The Religious Sense, is a very good, I think, a good treatment of the relationship in some ways between religion and reason. And then, of course, C.S. Lewis' book on miracles, I think, is one of the great texts in the 20th century. Yeah, living in hope. I think when I think of that, I suppose what I would ask is, if I were going back to that example of Daryl Davis, before 200 people converted from the came out of the KKK, if you were to say on the front side of that, how likely is that? I think I'd say, like, that's just not going to happen. And yet it's only the person who hopes that actually moves into the world in such a way that something like that happens. And so how likely is that? It's hard for me to say on a human calculus. I don't think of it as likely. And yet hope in the classical tradition is called a theological virtue because its object is God. And what hope says is, well, whatever is likely here, God still exists. And that always creates the capacity for surprise. And actually, perhaps the more we take up God on his capacity to surprise, he will surprise us. And so that's the headspace I want to dwell in, but I don't know if that gets at your question though, Rob.
Yeah, very well done. The human context and the humanist context. So having hope can exist in a humanist context. And so that is essentially hope versus despair. And if I live my life in despair rather than hope, I'm a pretty miserable person and probably yeah. I won't achieve the things that the hope would embody. So I think it's possible from both places, but there's no doubt that it can be strengthened through religious hope.
Yeah, that's the old definition, but right, it is certainly the case that I think just even the vague sense that, like, maybe more is possible than is in my imagination can be a great, an extreme, yeah, can help the world.
one of the things that we say about One in God's Name and the project that that generates this podcast is that our aim is hope for our shared common life. And Joseph, the way you gave a theological reflection on hope, for those of us who are part of this project and for those of us in our audience who do have a theological grounding, you articulated very well where that kind of hope can come from. And I'm going to try to tie together some threads here. But part of, you know, if we are going to avoid all of those words of crisis and problem and danger, risk about democracy, broken democracy, part of it is going to be about, again, back to your example of Daryl Davis, there's some human connection. I think that's where I want to identify this hope, but it's not, again, you say it so well, it's not something humanly that you might expect to happen, that there would be some, that human connection or breakthrough to see the humanity of the other. And it doesn't have to be theologically grounded. I'm glad, Rob, that you, you know, you talk about humanism, you know, a non-theological humanism that, that can also hold on to hope. I mean, the description of how that hope would work is different from a theologically grounded description of hope, but there's a functional similarity, I think, if we teased it out even more. So yeah, hope for our shared common life. A piece of that hope is recovering or rediscovering the humanity of the other, the way that and maintaining conversation, not ending the conversation. I don't want to sound too Pollyanna-ish about this because it's very hard and there's no guarantee it's going to work. But hard-nosedly spoken, that's what has to happen.
Yep.
I think we're going to need to leave it here. There's a ton more, Joseph, I would love to ask you and Rob have your input on as well. But we do need to stop. And I just want to say we have been talking today with Dr. Joseph Minnick. He's currently the residential teaching fellow at the Davenant Institute in Landrum, South Carolina. I think I'm going to say that some of what you said today, Joseph, came from your book, from your most recent book about atheism and divine absence in a secular age.
Yeah, there's definitely some overlap and some talking points there for sure. Yep.
So we'll have that in the show notes. And as you can tell, Joseph is a great, great, great person to have a good conversation with. Joseph, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
If you like what you've heard today and you like what the What in God's Name Project is doing, please consider sponsoring our work for less than a dollar a week on Patreon. It's barely any money for you, but it means a lot to us. And so we thank you.